friendships, and recovery. Again, that's Medicare Fully Fabulous, Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kvu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KVU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures, a community forum about the use of drones. This community forum on the use of drones will take place Thursday, August 7th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. Speakers include retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, Brian Whiteside, Peter Lumsdaine, and Oregon State Representative Jennifer Williamson. Again, that's Drones in Oregon, a community forum on Thursday, August 7th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland, the time is 5:01 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, over 60 Palestinian civilians are killed in an Israeli airstrike on a market during what was supposed to be a humanitarian ceasefire. We'll have a full report from Gaza.
A hunger strike at an immigration detention center in Washington enters its second day, with hunger strikers calling for an end to deportations.
A proposed gas terminal on the northwest Oregon coast gets one step closer to fruition.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 1st, 2014. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterland. In Gaza today, a 72-hour ceasefire that was supposed to begin at 8 a.m. ended just 2 hours after it began, with an Israeli missile dropped on a crowded market in Rafah that killed 60 people. Israeli forces had already violated the ceasefire before this bombing. Within 2 hours of the time the ceasefire was set to begin, Israeli troops had killed 4 Palestinians. Resistance factions responded by infiltrating an Israeli military base and abducting an Israeli soldier. For more on the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, we go to the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
A 72-hour ceasefire collapsed only 90 minutes after it went into effect on Friday morning when the Israeli military shelled the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah. According to Palestinian medical sources, at least 47 Palestinians were killed on Friday. The Israeli military claims that the shelling came in response to a group of Palestinian fighters who ambushed Israeli soldiers inside Rafah area and managed to capture an Israeli soldier alive, according to Israeli sources. Meanwhile, Hamas said that the attack on the soldiers took place before the ceasefire went into effect, and Israel used the capture of the soldier as a pretext to break the ceasefire. From Gaza, IMEMC's Ramil Mighari.
This is a sort of an indiscriminate Israeli fire that is ongoing here in the Gaza Strip. Whether the Israelis have claims or if they have allegations, have their own pretext, their own excuses for killing the civilians, it is still the same result, actually. The killing of civilian population of Gaza. The strikes are very mad. For the past hour, for example, we have heard frequent Israeli air strikes on the area. By every second, we have a sound of a shell or a rocket. This is a sort of an apparent escalation by the Israeli military troops amidst the failure of the mediation talks that are underway. By different parties concerned in this world.
The Palestinian Ministry of Health reports that more than 1,493 killed and at least 8,000 injured since Israel started its war on Gaza on July 8th. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the ceasefire in a statement Thursday and was to be followed by negotiations in Cairo. However, due to this violation of the ceasefire, Egypt said it will not welcome negotiation teams unless a ceasefire is in effect. Israel accepted the 72-hour ceasefire, apparently to ease the pressure it is under after targeting a school that belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, in the Gaza Strip, killing more than 15 Palestinian civilians who took the school as a shelter after their homes were destroyed by Israeli bombardment. Israel demands any ceasefire to include allowing its troops to search for and destroy tunnels. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance demands a lift of the imposed siege before any long-term ceasefire can be accepted. Fouad Koukele, a member of the Fatah bloc of the Palestinian parliament, comments.
The fact that Israeli troops remained in the Rafah area looking for claimed tunnels thwarted the ceasefire. There will be no real ceasefire unless Israel agrees to lift the siege and to get life back to normal in the Gaza Strip.
On the ground, Palestinian and international aid workers are racing time while being under constant threat of attacks by Israeli warplanes to get supplies to residents in Gaza. Recent reports show that more than 240,000 people have now fled their homes. Refugees have nowhere safe to go or clean water and food supplies since Israel destroyed water and electricity systems. And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine, Gaza special coverage. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org.
A protest against the Israeli assault on Gaza is currently underway outside the federal building in downtown Portland. KBOO's Theo Burke is there and joins us live from the scene. Theo, what's the scene like now in downtown Portland?
Hi, hopefully you can hear that the protesters are chanting, "Let Gaza live." They have signs that say that, and apartheid is wrong for South Africa in 76, wrong for Gaza today. There's about a dozen or 15 that were here. They were met with by federal police at one point, who just kind of talked to them and watched them. One of them engaged them in a discussion on the issue, asking them why Hamas keeps firing rockets. So the folks interviewed them. And they're still about 10 strong, and they're getting, you know, the usual honking from their supporters here on the southwest corner of 3rd and Madison. And I'm talking with Reverend Gary Grofwalner. He's a retired pastor affiliated with St. Andrew's Lutheran. The groups out here today, by the way, are Lutherans for Justice, Central Lutheran Church, and most of them are affiliated with the ELCA portion of the Lutheran Church, and also at least one Catholic person was out here too. So mainly Lutherans. And Gary, why are you guys out here today, Reverend?
Well, we're committed to peace and justice within our Christian tradition. And I've had an opportunity to talk to Palestinian Christians on the West Bank who have said, now that you've heard our story, you need to tell it to your communities and to your congregations and your friends. So that's why I'm here.
And what's been the response of passersby?
Say it again.
What's been the response of people passing by?
Some people give a thumbs up. Some people take a flyer that we're handing out. We're encouraging people to contact their congregational representatives in Congress, the congressional representatives, because the U.S. is funding what Israel is doing in terms of both the occupation of the West Bank and the siege of Gaza. And it's just, people aren't free. They're in a prison.
So do you know of any?
Oh, go ahead.
Has there been any response, or do you know of any response from the offices of Senators Wyden or Merkley?
We haven't heard anything thus far. Some of our group have contacted their office by letter. I have called, and I'm waiting for a response. One of the things that complicates all of this is that in America, it seems because of the corporate media's taking the propaganda that the Netanyahu government puts out, politicians are afraid to speak out because they'll be accused of being anti-Semitic. And our bishop said to some rabbis when he was recently in Bethlehem, and a rabbi said, well, friends don't talk to their friends like this. And he said, but friends don't lie to their friends either. And so we're called to tell the truth, because what's happening on the West Bank and what's happening in Gaza hurts Israel as well as the Palestinians.
So we
don't want to be funding it through our tax dollars.
Well, what do you think? What do you think about the vote then this morning in the U.S. Senate to approve an additional $225 million in military aid to Israel?
Oh, it just makes me ache. It just makes me ache. We have Jewish family members in our extended family who've married some of our daughters, and they've said this is hurtful to Israel, and it's certainly brutal to the Palestinians, and we don't support it.
And are there any more events being organized locally that you know of, or a website people could go to in order to know about what's going on here in Portland?
You know, I think there will be this fall. This little fledgling group that met today is going to start to meet weekly, and we know it's summer and people will be coming and going. So I look for it to grow as we pass the word within the community and within the congregations and the relationships we have.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Reverend Graffaller. Appreciate yours being with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for telling the story that's not always told.
Okay.
Peace to you. Bye.
And we've been speaking with Pastor Gary Graffwalner, an organizer of a vigil taking place right now in downtown Portland outside the federal building to challenge the Israeli attack on Gaza Strip. And thanks to Theo Burke for this live report.
Earlier today, a group of women dressed in black held a somber vigil to mourn the deaths in Gaza and to call for an end to the ongoing Israeli occupation. Maxine Fuchsen, one of the organizers, spoke with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg.
Tell me why you think it's important for Portlanders to come out to support the people of Gaza.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons for it. One is that we as taxpayers in Portland and the U.S. are totally complicit in our over $3 billion a year that we send to Israel. So the weapons that are being used are U.S. weapons, U.S. funded weapons. Even more now, the U.S. government has given Israel permission to use stockpiles of weapons in Israel to continue this massacre. So I think as American citizens, we have a huge responsibility. I also think that on a different level, not even a political level, there's a humanitarian crisis that has been happening for many, many years, minimum 8 years of an intense siege, blockade, embargo by Israel on all the borders of Gaza. So that's the background. The people of Gaza already were living on the edge of a humanitarian crisis and intensified, of course, over the last now 25 days of this onslaught of bombs and mortar shell from land, air, and sea, killing greater than 80%, according to the United Nations, civilian deaths and casualties, large numbers of children. So I think as human beings on this earth, we have a responsibility to care.
And what can people do at a local level?
We can do any number of things. One is contact any of the local groups, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, the student group Super at PSU, Jewish Voice for Peace, many of the church groups and religious affiliations. So get involved. There's lots of rallies and protests happening. I think writing now, calling our elected officials is absolutely crucial. Senator Merkley voted for a Senate resolution, one of a unanimous number of senators who voted for a resolution that supported Israel's, quote, right to defend itself, which is really a lie of as to why they're engaging in this war. So Merkley, who's running for re-election, needs to be contacted. There's also an upcoming House resolution, number 107, which is a parallel resolution to the Senate's, which blames Hamas, blames the Palestinians in Gaza for this massacre, and doesn't put any culpability at all on Israel. So I think writing to calling your elected, your U.S. representative is really important, and that's very important because that vote could come up soon.
That was local peace activist Maxine Fuchsen speaking with KABU from a Women in Black vigil held in Portland today.
Hundreds of immigrants held at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, started a hunger strike on Wednesday to protest the inhumane conditions of the jail. The for-profit prison company that runs the Northwest Detention Center has a history of mistreating its detainees and has been criticized by many immigration activists as inhumane. Over the past year, there have been several other hunger strikes aimed at improving food quality and quantity, medical care, and the dollar-per-day detainee work program that helps maintain the facility. The most recent hunger strike coincides with a march to the White House to pressure President Obama to pass comprehensive immigration reform. KABU's Henry Leisha interviewed a spokesperson from Latino Advocacy for more information on the protests.
With this current strike, how many people are participating in which detainees are participating?
Well, the numbers have fluctuated really, really fast. And when we started counting the number of people that were calling us from the different pods, we had at least 10 pods, about 150 people that were indicating they were joining the hunger strike. That was on Wednesday. By Thursday morning, many had decided not to continue because they were being pretty much intimidated. Yesterday, on Thursday, I don't know, maybe the early afternoon, some of our colleagues that were down at the detention center were able to take pictures of the riot team that belongs to the private corporation GEO. They were training in the parking lot just across from the detention center. There were about a dozen of them, all dressed in black, with black helmets on, and with big duffel bags, which we believe contained the riot gear. And they went in to the detention center. We know that Friday morning, a lot of people have also decided to leave the hunger strike because they were afraid. Two of our main organizers of La Colectiva de Detenidos, Cipriano Rios and Ramon Mendoza, had been called to the sergeant's office, and they were asked if they were organizing. They said, no, we never ask people to do anything they don't want to do. And they were told that if they are organizing this hunger strike again, they will be placed in solitary confinement. We are not surprised because this is the same strategy, retaliation strategy that was used back in March.
So you mentioned the GEO group, the for-profit prison company that actually runs the Northwest Detention Center. What else can you tell us about this company?
Well, it's an international company. They have over 78 facilities around the world. GEO has operated many detention facilities in the country for immigrants to be detained. But they also run private prisons. They charge anything between $120 to $160 per day per person to the federal government. This facility in Tacoma has a capacity of 1,575 people. And as we know, it's at capacity right now. They also provide something that they call the volunteer work program, where they ask people if they want to voluntarily work and do all the duties that are necessary to keep that entity going for $1 a day. So really it's the same immigrants that keep that facility running. They do the kitchen, they do the laundry services, they do the janitorial services. So the more we have learned how this company manages the work, the more we know how immoral it is. What they're doing, making money out of separating families. Detainees keep telling us that they're told by GEO guards that they're not in a prison, but they're actually treated as prisoners.
So what can you tell us about the conditions at the Northwest Detention Center in terms of, you know, things like visitation and the conditions of the cells, things like that?
Well, visitation is permitted just in a specific hours of the day and specific days. There's a strict code, dress code, for people to visit. The food has been a big issue for them. People have always complained that they're always hungry where they are in detention. When the last strike began, we were able to negotiate to get at least chicken once a week. That has happened since the last strike ended. But actually, just about 2 weeks ago, the kitchen was closed for about a week, and the detainees were not told about it. So the kitchen was supposed to be remodeled. And so throughout all that time, they only received slices of bread and some slices of cheese and a fruit a day, a fruit during breakfast, a fruit during lunch. So it was a very, very terrible situation they were living during those days that were, they were not informed that the kitchen would not be operating. In general, we know that this is not the best place to be in, but we know that GEO is ready to sign a renewal of their contract this October to keep going as the company that provides the services of detaining and separating families.
So how does this detention center fit into the larger deportation system as a whole? What kind of policies have led to this sort of situation?
Well, you, along with Correction Corporations of America, have been lobbying for many years for punitive laws that will guarantee that they have enough clients for the rest of their lives. The bed quota that Congress mandated some years back guarantees that these detention centers will always have people every day throughout the day and at any given point in the nation. The quota mandates that 34,000 people should be in detention throughout the nation. They obviously have been linked to many of also the local anti-immigrant policies such as SB 1070. And they are now also pushing for alternatives to detention because they are also managing the contracts of the ankle bracelets. So for people that are released, but they're given a special monitoring device to be worn. It turns out that the same company that is detaining people in this prison is the same company that is running that electronic system of monitoring. So they want to benefit in any way possible from the criminalization of immigrants. They really don't want any kind of reform in the law that will put them out of business.
We've been speaking with Maru Mora of the organization Latino Advocacy about a recent hunger strike in Tacoma, Washington, at a detention center holding people who will be deported soon. For KBOO News, I'm Henry Leisha.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 89, and Sunday's weather should be about the same. On this day in history, in 1842, a white mob attacked a parade of over 1,000 blacks in Philadelphia in what is now known as the Lombard Street Riot, setting off 3 days of attacks on the black community. And on August 1, 1914, Germany declared war against Russia, starting World War I. Then exactly 30 years later, the Warsaw Uprising against the Nazi occupation of the Polish capital was begun. The quote of today comes from Bertrand Russell. About the conflict between Israel and Palestine, he asks, "How much longer is the world willing to endure this spectacle of wanton cruelty?"
It's coming up on 5:25 in the evening. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The 2016 presidential primaries are a long way off, but look out, for here comes Rick Perry of Texas, riding his state's taxpayer dollars into the GOP primary. Technically, he's not campaigning, yet he's popping up from New York to California, holding press conferences, running TV ads, meeting with money people, and telling everyone how terrific he is. In other words, campaigning. Officially, his cross-country ramble is meant to promote Texas as a corporate utopia that offers state subsidies, zero income taxes, low wages, hands-off regulation, and other cushy deals for corporations that relocate to the Lone Star State. It's a hustle that glorifies Perry, even though he's using Texas tax dollars to take good-paying jobs from the places he visits and turn them into poor-paying jobs in his state. But the governor is used to tapping the public treasury to feather his own nest, and he has recently tapped it again to the tune of $450 an hour. That's for a high-dollar lawyer he's hired at taxpayer expense to try to save his bacon and his presidential fantasies. He doesn't mention it on his out-of-state Praise Perry tour, but he's presently on the brink of being indicted for corruption back home. This mess involves the governor's clumsy attempt to stop an investigation by the state's ethics office into one of his pet slush funds that funnel taxpayer money to his corporate campaign donors. Last year, using a personal lapse by the director of the ethics office as an excuse, Perry simply vetoed the office's entire funding. No office, no investigation, no problem. This is Jim Hightower saying, clever, huh? Except that other funding was made available, so that investigation continues. And then a special prosecutor investigated Perry's ham-handed veto, so now his indictment looms. This could take the wheels off his roadshow.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The World Trade Organization failed to meet its Thursday deadline for a global trade deal to loosen global customs rules. It would have been the first global trade deal reached by the institution since it was founded nearly 20 years ago. Negotiations collapsed when India refused to ratify the deal unless concessions were provided that would allow developing countries to subsidize and stockpile food. Several members of the organization have publicly reproached India for refusing to sign the pact. The United States and the European Union have been discussing moving forward with the deal without India. Representatives from India say they are willing to return to negotiations in September, but demand that concessions on stockpiling are granted. The last-minute failure to ratify the negotiations raised questions over the value of the World Trade Organization and where it's headed in the future.
Yesterday, the Portland City Council heard testimony on the issue of demolition of historic homes in Portland. A trend in the city has seen many of its single-family or historic homes destroyed in favor of building large apartment or commercial buildings. Public testimony showed that the public largely wants to see a process put in place. The following testimony comes from Jim Hoyer with the Portland Coalition for Historic Resources, Fred Leeson with the Bosco Milligan Foundation, and Kathy Gilberth from the Architectural Heritage Center.
Now, there are two reasons for the house demolitions: replacement of modest homes with more expensive ones, and replacement of homes on lots zoned for more residential units. About 45% are one for one, which is not truly one for one. It's one small for one very much larger. And that difference is in some cases dramatic. We have houses at $360,000 being purchased and replaced with new houses that will sell for $895,000. There are approximately 145,000 single-family houses in the city. Of those, 28,000, or roughly 20%, are zoned for higher density. With that, we really are hugely at risk. And of those, half are over 75 years old, and they have a median value of $272,000. So these are working-class houses that have a big red tag on them that says, "Tear me down."
What we're losing are houses built with old-growth wood and some of the finest building materials known to man. We're shipping them to the landfill. For the environment and the carbon footprint, we should be rehabbing and retrofitting instead of demolishing. The greenest building is the one that's already there. You've heard that. So how can we sit idly by while hundreds of units a year that we already have are being torn down one house at a time?
they see houses falling in their neighborhoods with no notice to be replaced by what many people said destroys the character of our neighborhood, and the city gives all the rights to the builders and none to those of us who live here. And this is what people said at the meeting. This is an equity issue as we lose scores of houses that have long provided affordable housing and starter homes. There's already so much concern about gentrification. You've been talking about that yourselves. The epidemic continues to push people of limited means and people of color out of the city. I can tell you bluntly that we've lost at least 14 buildings associated with Portland's African-American history that we documented. And we know, based on what Mr. Fish said, that you know, there are good builders and there are builders that aren't so good, and everybody is not getting the environmental inspection. Not only are the neighbors not being protected, the workers aren't being protected. There's no dust control measures. There's no fencing. These things are an attractive nuisance to kids.
We don't have a procedure to decide what should be saved and what shouldn't be saved. And we agree there are houses that should disappear. But we have no way of saying before they're gone, whoops, this one was historic because this was important because.
And again, that was testimony before the Portland City Council yesterday on the issue of demolition of historic homes in Portland.
On Thursday, the U.S. Department of Energy conditionally authorized a proposed liquefied natural gas terminal near the mouth of the Columbia River in Warrenton, Oregon. The Department of Energy, or DOE, reviewed only whether the LNG exports would threaten domestic energy security and whether they would promote market competition. The DOE review did not consider the environment at all, as it fell under an older system of departmental review that does not require environmental impact statements before issuing.